this presentation, actually, it's funny how they printed it. They printed it in a program, I think it's called Forget Best Practice. I guess they didn't like our title. Scratch Best Practice. It's all about beta, baby. We're really happy to see, actually, that they decided to put this on the last day, because this presentation is really about you. I mean, we've been here for a couple of days hearing about kids and hearing about classrooms and hearing about all the wonderful tools and things there are to do and all the things that you can do in your classroom. But this presentation is really, it's about us as teachers. So it's about the idea, now that we've heard all of this stuff, and we've all had this, you know, this experience that breaks open our brains and causes us all, you know, to lose sleep at night, the question is, how do you sustain that? And what does that look like as time goes on? Because really, in the society that we have today, we really have opportunities to continue this conversation and continue learning the same wonderful stuff that we've been working with for the last 3 days on a continuous basis. So this really, I mean, the presentation is in beta. And really, what we want to talk about is the history of this presentation is, you know, the wonderful David Jakes and myself were lucky enough to travel last September to Shanghai. And we did a session. It was just an unconference session where people asked to put together sessions. We want to talk about this. And so David and I decided that we need to talk about best practices. And so we were in a school in Shanghai, and the people were literally laying on the floor. There were so many people. The place was packed. There was no place to sit. People were standing on the walls and sitting in the middle of the classroom. There was no place to sit, but people were really interested in this idea of best practice. And so Darren and I started tossing this around and kind of came up with the idea, really, that, you know, or the question of, do best practices even exist? And is that kind of a notion that we should be kind of doing away with these days? So Darren and I have been throwing this idea around since September, and it's taken us, you know, however many months to actually wrap our heads around some kind of idea of where we wanted to go with this. So that's where we're going to begin today, is with the idea of best practice with a question mark.
Before we get started, we've got some resources for you online. So this entire presentation, the slides, the audio, everything, is going to be archived at on the wiki that I have for all my sessions at BLC. So the web address is tr.im/DK, is me, BLC09. So after this, you won't need to write anything down. The second thing I'd like you to take note of, and scribble this one down quick, is dig27cool. Dig27cool at photos.flickr.com. And what I'd like you to do is, while we're talking today, if you could pull out your cell phone or even use the screen capture on your laptop and just start taking pictures of what's happening in the room, anything you like. When we get towards the end of the session, we'll show you what happens to your pictures. Take those pictures and email them, or from your phone, send them to dig27cool@photos.flickr.com. Some of you have seen this shtick before, so if you have, just, you know, participate, join us, and those that haven't, we'll leave it as a surprise until the end. What we've also got is a back channel chat room available to you, and it's at todaysmeet.com/betababy. And if any of you are out on Twitter and you want to tweet that, it's todaysmeet.com/betababy. And let people who perhaps aren't in the room but may want to participate, the more participation we have, the better. I'll wait about 10, 15 seconds while you get some of that down, and then we're going to leap into the very beginning of the presentation. And I wish it wasn't Rose and Collins here, because I don't know if you can tell, we like to walk around. And we wanted to get into more of a conversation than a monologue. So various points here in the presentation, we're going to pause so that we have a chance as a group to debrief a little bit. Of course, some of the ideas we're talking about, we could go on for an hour, so inevitably we're going to be cutting that conversation short at points. So here we go. Thank you. plan today is to explore the idea of best practice. And I think what we're going to end up doing is kind of pulling the rug out of the idea of best practice. I want to start with the tale of two papers. A friend of mine is department chair for the social studies department, and he had the class marks from two different classes to see the principal. There's quite some concern about how students were doing in various classes. And when he brought these results to the principal on the desk, he had one class where the class really went very well. The class average was in the 70s, 100% pass rate, looked really good. The second class, however, had like an 80% failure rate. The class average was in the high 40s. And they were discussing this. And the principal said, well, this class is obviously doing well. That's good. But we need to speak to the teacher of this other class, because obviously there's some problems in that class. It was at that moment that my friend revealed the name of the teachers from the two classes, and it was the same teacher. So, teaching is not rocket science. It's way more complicated, way more complex than rocket science. Because you've got kids in your classes, maybe in the new school year, that will be different in the following school year, the following semester. You're going through changes yourself as you get better and better at your own sort of, at your own pedagogy. We go through curricular changes. And all this change in this dynamic environment means that some of these ideas about best practice don't really work. So I want to talk a little bit. I'm going to try to keep this really tight about the Tevin framework. I don't know if you've come across this. It's a Welsh word, Tevin. And it means place or habitat. And it's divided into these four categories, so we'll go through them very quickly, one at a time. How we make toast is pretty simple. You put toast in the toaster, you push the button, and out comes toast. Remember, bread goes in, toast comes out. And that's the notion of best practice. If you do X, you're going to get Y every time. Right? In one step, in one swell food, we know that's the way it's going to work. And that's what we call a simple kind of problem. It's more complicated to build a toaster. And the thing is, with building a toaster, if you go through all the steps involved in building a toaster, you're going to get a toaster every time. If you use the right materials in the right order, you end up with a toaster every time. We call that good practice, not best practice. Best practice is the idea that if we do something, we're going to get a desired result, and it's going to be consistent. Cause and effect are related one to the other immediately. We call good practice, well, you know, if you try this in your classroom, you're going to have to work at it, but it's going to take several steps, but you'll get there. You'll get there. But that's not regarded as good as best practice. The difference is that my clicker's not working. Simple practice is what we call that. Simple problems often have best practice outcomes. Complicated problems have good practice outcomes. These are ordered kinds of problems. Best practice and good practice. But teaching is more complicated than that, because things are changing all the time. It's not as simple as that. So a complex problem might be an example of, you all had breakfast this morning, and how you all decided to choose as a group, how everybody decided what they were going to have for breakfast, is a rather more complicated problem to figure out. Not only that, you might be able to now look back and say, well, I know what I had for breakfast. I didn't tell you why I made the choices that I made. But before you made those choices, probably didn't know what you were going to choose. So the relationship between cause and effect is not immediate. It's not connected. And we can look back in hindsight, and from that we get something called emergent practice. And in our classrooms, with kids changing all the time, curriculum changing, us getting better and better at our craft every time we go through it, what evolves in our classrooms is emergent practice. Another type of practice is chaotic practice. Like, you go to school in the morning and you just didn't have time to get that lesson plan together. And what am I going to do? That's chaotic. But sometimes really cool things happen when you walk into class not as prepared as you'd like to be, and that's what we get novel practice. These are unordered problems. You can't know in advance what's going to happen. You kind of jump in with both feet and see what happens, perhaps in hindsight. So let me look at an example of a chaotic problem. I don't know if any of you have ever been to India. No traffic signs in India. So this is what this looks like. And there's going to be a white car at the top right of the screen. Well, watch how the white car gets across the road, and look how they deal with traffic. Signals. I mean, to North American eyes, that looks like that's chaos. And yet, you know, he has a novel way of getting across the street. Now, if you drop a traffic cop on that street section, they'd make a mess. Right? If you drop a traffic cop right in that street section, but what's the problem with dropping a traffic cop into that street section? Because the traffic cop's going to try to bring an ordered practice to an unordered situation. He's going to try to solve an unordered problem using ordered methodology. And this is the problem with typical teacher training, is that in fact what we deal with in our classrooms are unordered problems. And teacher training often talks about best practice or good practice. Do this step by step, you're going to get that outcome. And that's just not the way it works. And that's what we call dysfunction. When you try to take an unordered problem and apply an ordered solution to an unordered problem, you get a dysfunctional result. And that's kind of what the idea of best practice is. The National Academies Press published a book recently with 7 principles about how students learn or do best. And they said the practices and activities in which people engage while learning shape what is learned. Well, you could replace people. Now, they were talking about students, but we could put teachers there. So the practices that we engage in while teaching shape what we teach. And so, are we applying ordered problem-solving solutions to an unordered problem? That's dysfunctional. We want to think about some way to do that. I'm going to turn it over to my colleague. We need to get back to this notion of playing with it, experimenting, and seeing what's going on. Clarence will talk a little bit about thinking.
Great. So, one thing that Darren and I were talking about when we were putting this presentation together is the fact that when you start talking just about best practice, it's almost like a cookbook, right? And that if you think of a lot of the, like a Basel Reader program or something like that, I mean, down to the fact that everything is scripted lots of times, the fact is that a lot of programs assume that there's one way to do things, right? And like Darren said, if you do X, you are always going to get Y. Now, when David and I originally ran into this kind of problem, we were in Shanghai last year at a teachers' conference that had people from all over Eastern Asia. Right? So you had teachers from Japan, you had teachers from the Philippines, Korea, China, Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, all over the place. And to them, they kind of looked at the idea of best practice and went, like, how is that even possible? When you're dealing with people from all these different cultures and regions and languages and religions, there's no such thing that could possibly work in one place and be applied to all of these other nations. And so, really, when you start thinking about your own school, your own kids, you know, thousands of different teachers, it really becomes common sense that there's no one single way of doing something that's going to work for all teachers and all kids, in all classrooms, in all schools, in all places. I mean, I can go on and on and on. And like the slide that Darren had showed, you know, teaching is a very complex act. So really what we're asking people to do when we're starting to think about emergent practice is think about yourself. Okay? Think about things that work for you in your place, in your time. I mean, that list goes on and on and on and on. So, like I said at the beginning of the session, is a lot of what we've been hearing the last couple of days is about classrooms, about the way you teach kids. But really, what we'd like in this next hour is for you to think about yourself. Think about your practice. Okay? What are the effective ways that you found that work good for you and your place. And like I said at the beginning, is we're trying to think of ways that you can extend these conversations. I mean, it's been a mind-blowing couple of days, and so we all need to go and rest. But the fact is, I mean, these kind of conferences, you know, getting these new ideas are the ways that bring us some change into our classrooms. So we need to be able to continue thinking in new ways. And we need to get new ideas at us all the time. So one way of thinking about best practice, the change, sorry, from best practice to emergent practice, is by thinking about tinkering. Okay? Tinkering is always something that's a very powerful idea. Okay? And tinkering really for a lot of years, especially in Western and North American society, went away. Okay? I mean, if you think about being a farmer in the 1940s, the 1950s, I mean, even to this day in lots of places, if something breaks down, you had to fix it. Okay? And you go have coffee with almost every old farmer, and they've all got their story about, well, you know, when this broke, this is what I did. And the guy 2 miles down the road said, well, that's not what I did. You know, I did this when that broke down, and it worked fine. And pretty soon the next old farmer, and on and on and on. But really, in our society, we lost that. Something broke, what did we do with it? Threw it away. So we've really lost that idea of tinkering. Okay? But tinkering is really starting to make a comeback now. Tinkering School is the most wonderful thing that you can look up on the internet. And this, the idea behind Tinkering School is the guy who runs it interviews kids from all over the place. They apply to get in, and basically they spend a week, like at summer camp, but they spend a week at summer camp like breaking stuff and making stuff, building bridges, and, you know, making all these wonderful things. Like, it's wonderful videos online of like 8-year-olds with power tools that make my wife cringe. You know, but it's that idea of when we play with stuff, you know, we get a lot of new ideas. And even if stuff breaks, it's okay. I mean, you look at it, well, that didn't work. I'm going to try something else instead. Hey, same, I don't know how many of you are familiar with Make Magazine, Make Podcast. Man, if you want to subscribe to a YouTube channel that'll wreck your brain, subscribe to the Make stuff. And it's all people playing with electronics and doing things and building stuff. And once a year, they have Maker Faire. And Maker Faire, I think it's held in the San Francisco or San Diego area. And again, you apply to get in, and they have this huge, it's like a town fair. But, you know, there's things you can see here, like fire trucks that spurt fire and all kinds of stuff. And again, it's just a place where people come together and show all the stuff that they've tinkered with. So they've taken stuff and they've improved it and they've done stuff with it and they've made it do entirely new things. And I think that idea of tinkering is really coming back because we're tired, number one, of people making stuff for us that we can't fix, that we can't change, that we can't do anything with. You know, the stupid thing, I spent $500 on it and it doesn't do what I want it. And instead, that idea of tinkering is really coming back. You know, I want this to do what I need it to do. And that's really the same as in our classrooms, right? John Seely Brown, okay, like David Weinberger this morning, you want to search out one guy's stuff, here's John Seely Brown. Hopefully.
What could we do better in schools today? Especially given the incredibly rapid pace of change today. Where most of our skills that we learn today, many of them are obsoleted 5, 6, 7 years ago. We have to kind of find a way to actually get our today's kids to embrace change. We have to get them to want to constantly learn new types of things. And the catch to me is somehow we have to find a way to get kids to play with knowledge.
Every time you hear the word kids, what teachers
play with creating knowledge. Not only believing that it's already known, but basically being willing to believe that maybe they should be able to create knowledge on the fly by experimenting with things. I think to me that the thing that we don't do much in school is actually look at ways to foster the imagination. Because if you don't have an imagination, you can't even start to be creative. Imagination by itself is not enough. But if you can't have imagination, then you can't really start to create. Then you have to be able to create and reflect. And you have to be able to create, reflect, and share. I think in that sharing, you start to build a whole new kind of culture because you're beginning to get kind of a peer-based learning. Because from the sharing, you begin to see how other kids are using what you just did. And so I think we're beginning to look at kind of peer-based learning communities where these kids can learn from each other as much as from the mentor amongst the authority figure and so on and so forth.
So John Seely Brown really tells us it's okay to play. You know, it's okay to try something out. And Darren and I are both going to go into ideas a little bit later about, you know, creating peer-based learning communities and how does that look like. But first, that idea of playing. I mean, we've been stuck for a long time really here, and we've been told that being here is bad. It's not really true. I mean, you've all been in the middle of a lesson that you thought was terrible, and yet it turns out to be the greatest thing ever because you made some adjustment on the fly, or something happened, or a kid asked a question that took you someplace that you've never thought of before. And it's the same thing really with our own practice. We plan. I'm not saying we don't plan when we tinker. We do our planning, we lay out our path, we think of where we want to go, but we need to be open to that idea of serendipity. Okay? When we try new things, okay, then we end up in new places. And being in new places is really important. Okay? So, I mean, your space is yours. Okay? I mean, you are the professional in charge of that space. You are the professional in charge of your practice. So what are you creating? You know, and really, that's a very important idea in teaching. Teaching is an act of creation. We're creating a space. We're creating a learning environment. It is like being an artist, an engineer, an architect. You're building something as time goes on. So that idea of tinkering, of taking stuff and looking at it and playing with it and getting new ideas wherever those come in from are really important. So what are some of the things we can tinker with? Well, we can tinker with some of the cognitive things that happen in our classroom. We can tinker with some of the physical layouts of our spaces. Okay? I'm really big into the idea of studio learning. When I think of classrooms, I want to think of architect studios, engineer studios, artist studios. So how can we tinker with the physical space that we've got? And last, of course, is digital tools. Okay. It's good to try out different things. You know, Darren and I often go back and forth, you know, kind of yelling at each other about, you know, well, you got to use this. No, you got to use this. Well, you don't know about that? It's like, no. So you tinker with those tools. You play with the tools that you use in your classroom. You play with the tools you use for yourself. You know, I can't tell you how many different accounts I've created all over the web in different places for tools that I abandoned 5 days later. But that's okay, because out of those tools, then I guarantee some of them have turned into the most valuable sources that I've got. Okay? So it doesn't need to feel like failure. It needs to feel like tinkering. You're trying things out. You're finding places where you might be interested in doing something. Okay? So now tinkering. Anybody have any ideas? Let's talk. So we're going to pause, like Darren said. We've got, I think, three sections like this. We wanted to take about 5 minutes and see what kind of ideas you've got about tinkering. Any tinkering experiences, ideas of tinkering in your classroom, things that you might be that you think might be valuable.
Also, just to help frame that discussion, and then we'll be quiet. So what we tried to do is say there's no such thing as best practice, and pull the rug out under from what typical teacher training looks like, because we say it's not that kind of problem we're trying to solve in our classroom. And then we've also tried to come back with at least one place to begin thinking about one idea that you can use to start solving that problem, which is playing with cognitive tools, playing with the way you teach, the curriculum you deliver, playing with the physical space of the rooms in which you work and where the students are learning, and playing with digital tools, which may impact both of those other things. So what do you think? We're going to give this about 5 minutes, and we're going to call it.
I think that we're remapping, if we're imaging.
So best practice isn't what we used to call it, but what we call emergent practice is best practice. Do I understand that right?
That's the new best practice.
Okay. So like an evolving definition of the word.
Yeah.
Okay. David?
When we do, we have kids use Microsoft for Story 3 for digital storytelling. I've given up on teaching them a lot of ways, the process of using the software. So there are a couple places where I might have come through. For the most part, it, I can see their eyes are important. They want to create a program on it, play with the computer, but they learn it there on their own.
Yeah.
They're used to it.
Yeah.
It's interesting watching the process. And you see this intersection of posting their piece
kids don't read the manual. I mean, we play the most complex video game in the world. They play, and then when they get stuck, oh, then I'll go look up whatever I need to. Yeah, that's...
Do many of you read the manual? How many people read the manual? I sometimes do.
My
usually I don't. Okay. There was another... Yeah.
Because I have them in threes, and then I have them in fours, then I have them in, you know, we had like a little auditorium set up. I guess that was tinkering, which would be the best way for my kids to collaborate.
That, and I think that you hit on a very important point, like John Seely Brown said. I mean, you do it, and then you think about it. I mean, it's not just doing a bunch of stuff. Tinkering is doing a bunch of stuff, and then reflect what worked.
You know, when you said that, space really impacts how people learn in that space. And I don't like these desks and these chairs. It bugs me. It's too rigid, confining, right? I prefer to see little groups of tables in there. And so what do the spaces they walk into? Is the space welcoming and encouraging, or is it discouraging and confining? Right? And that influences what we teach as well.
Them.
Yeah. Can you speak very loudly, please?
Sorry, I have to sit down there. What I found is, you know, I would go to these conferences and I would come out with so much information that I couldn't process it all along with my rest of my life. And I would give a little bit to some of my students and they would just latch onto it, give up their lunch period, just like a quickie animation. They figured out the program that Pixar was using to develop Shrek. And then they taught me. And, you know, but they gave up their time, and they became a teacher. I was a student.
That's wonderful. I think there's a lot more we could talk about here, but we're going to cut the conversation short. We're going to have another pause, so keep the idea in your mind or jot it down. So the structure of the presentation was we removed the rug from under you. There's no such thing as best practice, and now we're going to try to put a three-legged stool in its place. The first leg was this notion of tinkering. The second, being there.
I'm Chance, the gardener. The garden? Yes. Since I was a child, I've worked in this garden.
Then you really are a gardener?
Oh, yes.
May I ask your name?
The gardener.
Mr. Chancy Gardner, are you related to Basil and Cunita Gardner?
No, I'm not related to Basil and Cunita.
So, I mean, if you've seen the film, right, he's basically a simpleton, and he had been a gardener for a wealthy man who passes away, and he's become homeless. And through a series of mishaps and circumstance, through serendipity, through chance, he becomes advisor to the President of the United States, a very wealthy man, just through a series of mishaps. And it's just because he happened to be in the right place at the right time. You can't really plan for that. It's hard to plan for serendipity. But then the question arises, well, how can I put myself in places and arrange my exposure to different ideas or different things going on professionally so that I might be in a place where chance happens, where serendipity befalls me? So again, from the National Academies Press, they say learning is enhanced through socially supported interactions. Well, now they were talking about kids, but no different for us as teachers. In the future, your digital footprint will carry much more weight than whatever you include on a paper resume. Now, if these things are true, we're going to make the suggestion that one place you can go to get this social support is a personal learning network like Twitter. And I know some of you have been to sessions, some of you have given sessions on using that. Now, a couple of days ago, the date on this is July 27th, so it's literally just a couple of days ago. And a fellow in California is giving a workshop to a bunch of teachers being exposed to Twitter for the very first time. We've never heard of it. And he tweets out on Twitter, you know, tell us where you are and what you something helpful about Twitter for my students to learn here. So Dean Shuresky is an educator in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, Canada. It's separated far in time, well, in space. At that time, Dean says, if you're going to consider Twitter, be prepared to be social and personal. If you're you're not prepared to do that, it might not work for you. So, now, I think Dean represents some, those of you who know Dean from online, he shares everything. Like when his family has a family game tonight, it's video cast. Okay, that's more than I do. I share my personal life. No, I don't share my personal life. My personal life is private, but I do share my professional life. Everything that I am as a professional, as an educator, is completely transparent. You can find out absolutely everything about me, including what happened in my classroom on any day and any day of the year for the last 5 years. And you can get a big, complete picture of what's going on from online. And this is part of our social presence. So Twitter is one way to get that social support. When you're going to try something, you start tinkering something, is this going to work? I want to tell you something else. There was an educator by the name of Lee Baker, who was a wonderful lady, was connected socially online to all these people. And about a year and a half ago, Lee passed away. It was very sudden and unexpected. And she had a lot of friends on. I followed Lee on Twitter, and I'm still following on Twitter, Lee. And I can't make myself unfollow her. Anyways, some people got this idea a couple of days ago. Literally, a few days ago. The anniversary of her death has just come and gone. And they wanted to establish something called the Lee Baker Award. In her honor. The idea is find a teacher somewhere who is thinking about incorporating these tools in their classroom, but doesn't have all the social connections and maybe all the background and abuse the tools, etc. But they'd like to try something out. And we're going to get a volunteer of people from all over the world, we're going to get a volunteer pool of people who will be that person's instant support network. And whoever wins this Lee Baker Award will have access to a global community of experienced educators who've used the digital tools in their classrooms, in practice, and kicked the tires, stumbled, and picked themselves up again. And any time of any day, that person will have access to that network to say, here's where I'm at, can I get some help? And they'll get it, like this. And that's something that comes from the social presence. Right? This comes from, we started connecting over digital tools, but it became far more than that. The second thing is your cognitive presence. Your cognitive presence is really represented by, and if you haven't started one yet, I strongly recommend it, your blog. Twitter is kind of like, it's a very social space, and there is some cool stuff that can happen on Twitter, but it's really more about social interactions. Good things come from that. But your cognitive presence, when you've got a deep problem you need to sort out, well, a good place to do that is your blog. I'll give you an example. I blogged about, I had watched a presentation about how to give good presentations, because I try to bring that down into my classroom. If it's good for teachers, it's good for kids. So I wrote this whole post, and I had a lesson that I had done in class that day, and I published all the slides to the lesson. I do that every day. And then I threw it out there, and I said, anyone, like, I think this is better than it was last year, because I put the two up side by side from a year ago to this year. And I said, but I think there's a lot of room for improvement. So anyone, please, you know, tear this apart and help me figure it out. And what happened was Dan Mayer, who teaches in California, another math teacher, he took my slides and actually took a single slide, completely redesigned the lesson around the one slide. And my slide was just plain text on a white background. It was a simple problem for kids to work out. He redesigned it. He goes and uses a Google map and he looks at Toronto because he says all Canadians live in Toronto. And he designed, you know, it was a route that you took either on the perimeter of the city or through the main part of the city. And he built this whole map and develops this whole new problem to get at the idea and math of the range, the difference between the highest and lowest value. Well, this other educator on the East Coast who has a blog, the Number Warrior, says, you know what, Dan, you could have done a lot more work than just the range for all that. It's a very simple idea. And he redesigns the entire lesson. There's my original slide. It's now been repurposed twice. And he redesigns the entire lesson and starts and gets at the idea of the standard deviation, a much more sophisticated statistical idea, which is what I'm trying to get in my class. Well, from my end, these two guys just play my class for the next time I go through the course. But the pushback that I got from them is now affecting me. Every time that I design a slide in my class, this has had an impact on me. Then Dan talks about the redesign that this fellow did on his redesign of my design. And so so it goes. The idea got picked up, it was discussed in various blogs all across the net, and I'm able to track that using a website called secondarality.com and see what's going on. So this is part, that's one part of the puzzle, is having, yes, the social presence for the support, but also the cognitive presence. Here's a problem I'm wrestling with. Can you help me figure this out and sort this out? And that's what we mean by cognitive presence. Because the blog is when you have more meaty problem. Twitter is kind of like light stuff. And then lastly, my professional presence. Every class I have taught, every class for the last 5 years, every single one has got a class blog. That's a list of them. Every class has their own blog, and all their content is published on the web. And everything I do in that class as a professional is published on those class blogs. Also on SlideShare, every day the lessons, every day, every class, the good, the bad, the ugly, it all gets uploaded to SlideShare. So that's an example of some of the presentations that I've done. Now, I want to show you this because the other day, I gave a workshop here, yesterday, I gave a workshop called Extreme Lesson Plan Makeover. And I uploaded it to SlideShare. And at around, and I was up late working on this presentation, so it was around 1 in the morning last night. The presentation I had uploaded had about 9 views on SlideShare, and I got an email from the folks over at SlideShare. And they told me that my presentation had just been highlighted, and there it is on the front page of SlideShare, and is being promoted as one of the best slideshows on SlideShare today. Now, I don't draw that to your attention. Thank you. It's not about me. I didn't plan that. When I discovered this last night, I'm like, I'm going to be talking about this stuff tomorrow. These guys couldn't have done me a better favor. It's serendipity. I did not put that online so that I would get highlighted on SlideShare. I put that online so that the teachers that read the session yesterday could still have access to it and maybe talk about it and wrestle with it and look at it and share it with other people elsewhere. But that was cool. Now what happens, my views, what is it, 200 and something now? 209. Okay, so more than that? Whatever, it's over 200. Okay, so it's over 200 views. And so because it's on the front page, that's going to go up. Why is that good? Not because I get a lot of views. What's really good is if I get that 0.01% of people that look at it and say, and offer a suggestion, this slide better than that. If you can try this, or I like what you did here, or you know what, I like this idea, here's another resource. And that's part of my, you know, that's my professional presence on the web. So the three pillars of my presence is my social presence and the interaction I have with friends that we make through something like Twitter or other presence tools that I get. The cognitive presence that you exhibit by having a blog, sharing the stuff you're struggling with, and your professional presence by sharing everything that you do as a professional. Not talking about your personal life, your professional life. Sharing your professional work that you're completely transparent. And some of the ways that David Weinberger has done. Because lots of good stuff comes from that. I gotta go back to the slideshow. So, that's the third part of the stool we're trying to put back in place once we've taken out best practice. And we've got about 5 minutes to chat about it. Anyone has something they want to share? Yeah.
It's interesting because if in fact I get the sense that the initial point that you were making was that we have a tendency to assume that there's best practice out there, and if someone has it, we can bring them to a school district and give it to the teachers. Mm-hmm. And yet, haven't we transitioned into that in this presentation at this point? In the sense that you've given us the three schools?
Okay, so the question is the problem with best practice is the idea that you can go into a school district or a school and give teacher tools so that they can do it from A to B and get there in one step, what we call best practice. And we said that's not the way it works. And now you're pushing back and saying, well, haven't we just put in the best practice again? I would say no. And here's why. Because I can't tell you that if you start blogging now, you're going to get the kind of reaction and feedback that's going to happen from, like, that interaction I had with Dan and Jamie. Okay?
But that's exactly what happens. In other words, because you've given us this illustration of blogging very successful for you, we have the sense that maybe we should go back and blog to know what we find out is that we don't get that reaction, and therefore we stop using blogs.
Okay, yeah, and you're right. When people start blogging, you don't get that reaction. When I started blogging, the first 6 months, felt like it was a conversation with myself. But over time, as you continue to share, people share back, they push back at you. I'm not telling you, I'm not saying that this is the recipe for fixing best practice. I'm not making that claim at all.
Can I tell you?
What I am saying is that how do you manage being, solving a complex problem and being in a state of near, not chaos, but trying to manage all the different dynamic balls that you're trying to juggle in your classroom? This is one way to start thinking about moving your pedagogy forward. It may work for you, it may not, and then we got to start looking at other ideas.
Can I give you a personal story?
Please. But Darren, I'm going to stand there so everyone can hear you, okay?
Darren and I met 2 years ago, and someone said to me, when I asked the question, how can I become more familiar with this world of Web 2.0, what should I do? And the person said to me, start a blog. And get on Twitter and develop a personal network. Well, I started the blog, and I certainly don't get the response when I put out a post that Darren gets. What I do get is a lot of personal satisfaction because I'm intellectually being able to engage with thinking about the material that I'm trying to process through these kinds of conferences and my reflections on reading and my interaction with staff, students, and teachers. And it's been very valuable from that point of view. So I guess the point I draw from this is that Darren has had one experience with blogging. I've had a totally different experience. And the point is, you should go out and start blogging if you're not doing it, and you'll have a totally different experience.
Yes.
But that is the practice we're looking for. We want to find out how we all learn different ways using that kind of a platform. That's my takeaway.
Anyone else?
Now, there has to be some kind of solution to that, because what you want to have is response. And when I started blogging, it was more like navel gazing, right? Because you truly are a minnow in the ocean. But what I have literally in the last year changed the way that I link up with parents through students and link up with teachers through their students. So as soon as you have another venue, you do other things that have a different venue that points back to your blog, they're not going to find you if you're in the minnow near Hawaii. You have to have some way to have them start fishing for you, so to speak. So you have to have other things that draw them to that. And usually that's some way of presenting student work or some way of presenting stuff to teachers so that they want to come to you and say, hey, how can we do some of that cool stuff?
Sure.
Then you'll have that response. I'm still maybe like a dollar.
Yeah. I'm looking up. What David Weinberg was saying about linking and sharing, like it's a little gift that you give when you link to someone. So when you do something interesting and when you share a problem and someone links back to you, it's a little gift that's being given. And so the more you give, you'll get far more back than what you give. So as you link out to other people, it draws their attention to you, and you'll see you'll get back even more. But by the way, if anyone hasn't had a chance to take any of those pictures yet, take
a good time. While we're wandering around. All right, one other idea, and actually the last idea that we want to bring forward, is the idea of feeding the source. Okay, that I think Darren's made a good point with the idea of professional presence and social presence. There's all these things that, as Darren says, kind of putting yourself in the stream of ideas. That's a good way to help us examine our practice and think about what emergent practice, how our practices can change. But we need some ideas about feeding that stuff. You know, it's great to stand up here and say, well, you need to get information from different places. But it's hard to know where to start often. So the big idea is just that, you know, it needs to be fed. Your brain needs to be fed. Now, there's lots of different ways you can do that. There's lots of different places that you can get your ideas from. But the idea is to put yourself in the channel. Okay? Yesterday, that in a presentation that I gave, I had somebody talk to me afterwards because one of my slides, talking about kids and information, is I really believe that the channel is more important than any single piece of content that comes through it. Okay? So, for example, Twitter. I love Twitter. My wife hates Twitter. You know, there's a relationship there. But the thing with Twitter is there a lot of junk on it? Certainly there is. But, you know, a nugget comes through there several times a day. And by being present in that stream of information, okay, I'm there to catch that when it floats down the stream. I believe the same thing with kids. You know, the kids in my classroom subscribe to a lot of blogs. Is there stuff that comes through there that's useless to them? Certainly there is. But by being present in that stream of information, they are there to catch the valuable stuff when it comes by. It's the same thing with us as teachers. Okay? When I read a lot of blogs, when I'm on Twitter, when I have Skype phone calls with people, and you know, you're just sitting around chatting, and they'll say, hey, have you taken a look at this? Oh, all of a sudden it's something that, you know, it's kind of made my mood. So that idea of being present in a lot of different social systems, okay? Twitter might be one, your blog might be one, Delicious with social bookmarking. You know, if you're present in a lot of these places, then a lot of new ideas have the potential to impact you. Okay? Just by having a Delicious account and following a few people on Delicious, every time somebody bookmarks something that I follow on Delicious, I get that. And it gives me a chance to look at it. It might only be a 10-second look. No, I'm not interested in that. That's fine. But then the next day, something's going to come through there that's really going to impact me. There's a website that somebody's bookmarked with a really great article that I not need to read. Or some really great lesson plans that I think I can take and remix and work with. But by being present in those kinds of social systems, then I'm constantly being fed. It gives me a chance to do some thinking and some reflection about what kind of things work for me and what kind of things don't work for me. Okay? Now, this is really that idea of the minnow and all of that stuff out there. There's a lot of junk on the web. Man, it's incredible. You know, like David Weinberger said this morning, there's all kinds of stuff out there. And a lot of it's junk. It's like the iceberg. But by having this human feed, by knowing, you know, people that I've chosen to follow on Twitter, or people whose Delicious accounts I look through, or people whose blogs I read, then by filtering all that out, I end up with a really strong signal. I'm getting stuff that works for me. Now, what I think is really important with this is the idea that it's perfectly okay that your stuff is different from my stuff, is different from your stuff. We all need a different, you know, we all need to stand in different streams of ideas. Because your school is different from mine, your place is different from mine, you're different from me. And I think what's really powerful is the idea that that's okay. And I think that's part of this idea of emergent practice, is the signal that we all need is different. Okay? You teach a different subject, you work with different age kids, you have different skills than I have. So by going through some kind of, you know, people that you trust, you're going to end up with a much stronger signal that works for you. Okay? So let's see John Seeley again.
Well, I think the technology actually can play out in some very interesting ways. Now notice much of what I just said doesn't really require high-tech technology, especially taking the architectural studio and using that as a metaphor. On the other hand, a lot of today's network technology enables us to build distributed communities of practice. So the example I gave a second ago was working shoulder to shoulder with another student. But maybe now it's only my avatar is working shoulder to shoulder. And maybe what I now have is infinitely more powerful tools to be able to craft things with. Infinitely more powerful tools to mash things up. But tinkering today has really come back big time, because the tools that I now use in the digital world not only allow me to create, but allow me to remix. Allow me to take fragments of things that are built around me, smash them together in interesting ways. So suddenly I'm in a world which I can borrow somebody else's partial constructions or total constructions, take pieces out of them, put them in mind with credit, and then be able to build new things more rapidly. So perhaps now it's easier than ever to stand on the shoulders of people that came before me. So I start to kind of get this sense of looking around, seeing if I can use what other people have done, tearing some pieces of it apart, repurposing those pieces, adding new pieces to it, constructing something way beyond what the other person ever had in mind, making it possible for me to get a hell of a lot more done in a very short period of time. So I kind of expand my own creative prowess, so to speak. And from that, also turn that back into the community. So I think that this network world is basically an open source world where I can put my stamp on something and then pass it back to the community and be able to have that community to do things with it.
I think he's really got some very powerful points about that idea of sharing your stuff. Hey, when you stand in that stream, oh, there was the gala voice there. Kind of when you stand in that stream and are able to get that information that comes through all these different channels, whatever works for you, whatever kind of information you need, you know, those channels really change you because you begin to realize how big of a world it is out there, how many things you don't know, you know, and where there's all these powerful pieces of practice that you've probably been missing. I know I was astounded with the ideas, you know, just the information that's out there. And, I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there. And there's a lot of different channels that we can choose to work with. But that idea of emergent practice, again, is very powerful because as we learn new things, again, I'm beating it to death now pretty soon, but as we stand in that stream, you know, we begin to realize how many things are out there that we need to reconsider. And it really changes our idea of practice. It really changes what's possible in our classrooms. When we start, you know, instead of working with ideas just of, well, this is best, to, I wonder what's going to work. Okay. So that idea, again, of tinkering, of coming back, of being present in places, of getting information from all of these spaces, and letting that inform our practice is very, very important. Okay. So now, again, let's talk. Anybody have any ideas about this?
So the three things we talked about, we said there's no such thing as best practice. It's all about this idea of being in a perpetual state of beta, regrowth, constantly thinking, okay, what's next? What am I going to do now that I couldn't do before? What's new affordances make things possible or new things possible in my classroom that weren't possible before? And if I have to live in this state of constant flux, then how do I do that? Well, you're going to need social supports. So you're going to need some kind of social presence. And you have to have that attitude of play. Some of the people that are best in what they do, they have two characteristics that distinguish them. They have a wonderful sense of humor, and they have a wonderful sense of play. So we need to bring that into our practice. How do I play with what I do? And that's the idea too. And then your presence, your social presence, your cognitive presence, and your professional presence, so that serendipity can be taught.
Yeah.
And then, am I trying to tell someone that? No, complex.
Yeah, but remember, this is about you. This isn't necessarily about, you know, what my playbook looks like. This is about me as a professional. This is about how do I get these new ideas about what might be good teaching into your classroom. So I think what we're trying to tackle on today is not necessarily the idea of, you know, this is what it's going to look like Monday morning, but this is how I can adjust my practices long term. So I don't think it's, I mean, we're not trying to double your planning about it.
Lot of
I think you're right that it's a very difficult space to stand in, you know, because we are used to best practice, cause and effect. And I think this is a much more complex, but it's really a much more professional space to stand in, because we need to be ready for that complexity. We need to be ready for that dichotomy.
Chaotic practice can lead to novel practice, but not necessarily will. We more often live in the top left corner.
Yeah. Now, this is kind of a nuts and bolts question. How do you deal with, and we obviously don't live in a vacuum, we have colleagues that we work with, how do you deal with someone or and this could be a child, easily a student or a colleague or a parent, how do you deal with one of those people who doesn't agree with that kind of flexibility, who feels they're, you know, because not everybody's ready to go this way. And how do you deal with, say, those kind of individuals without getting into a conflict? I mean, I've had very often, you know, I've had students who think that there's only one right answer, you know, or parents who are, or colleagues, you know, I mean, all that. I mean, that's a pretty broad question. I'll be here for days, but...
Well, I guess my question to them would be, have you ever taught the same lesson 2 years in a row?
Okay.
And did it work out the same both times? Well, if not, then obviously there's something happening underneath there.
Perfect.
Right? There's something deeper level that's going on, and that's really what we're trying to say.
So throw back a question to that person, like, have you ever sat down?
He says them.
Okay.
Sorry. No.
No, I thought you were
going to. No. You touched on something really important. This is not a comfortable session. This is not, and we're not talking about being in a comfortable place.
Right.
We're talking
about
being in a very uncomfortable place.
Right.
And you're quite right. I have the lion's share of my colleagues wouldn't entertain half the ideas we're talking about. So you change what you can, and the stuff you can't to accept and you deal with. And what can you change? Really only yourself. And if you're interested in the kinds of ideas that we're talking about, and you're saying, but how do I deal with the discomfort of being in a place like that? So what we've tried to do is say that playful tinkering attitude is one thing you're going to need. You're going to need the social support and the cognitive support and the professional support. And you also have to be willing to set up channels that bring feedback into you. So feed the source, get the support you need from the people you need, because they may not be the people in your building.
Right, right. And I was going to say, but the whole thing about you, I mean, you have to be able to laugh at this and at yourself, and if you can't come out of it with a, you know, I've laughed more this week than I've ever laughed in any professional development I've ever been to, you know. And that is, you know, it has really helped tremendously, because there is a lot of, you know, I feel overlooked. But at the same time, that whole attitude, and the attitude of be a Gumby. Mm-hmm. For those of you who aren't old enough, Gumby is the character you're probably watching on. Can you watch
on YouTube? Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I would say that's a wonderful observation. Do you have laughter in your classroom by design?
All the time.
See, if we design, because laughter does all sorts of wonderful things.
And kids, they say, who is they? Maybe whatever. But I have heard, read, understood that kids laugh 100 times a day, and adults maybe once a day.
Well, and that's one thing. I can't tell you how many times my best blog posts have been ones that I've written about falling on my face in my classroom. This just didn't work. But, you know, even with that, I didn't hide that. I write blog posts saying, look, I sucked. You know, this just didn't work. And yet the best feedback I've got have been from those, from people coming back and saying, I get it, try this.
Sorry, we went over my
sorry.
Now, what I'm thinking is, aren't we still having some kind of food that we still have? We're just getting there a different way. We're sparking a different way.
Sure.
I was also thinking about, with your question, too, there's like a difference between reflection and candy.
Yes.
You know, I think that was a question. A lot of that is what we do all the time. But I just think that the best way to sort of sum in to colleagues with a question or whatever is share it.
Yeah.
Share it when they see. Remember, we still get an assessment.
Gandhi said, be the change that you wish to see in the world.
Right.
Yeah. So we want to tie this up, and then I want to tell you what happened to your pictures, and then we'll call it a
day. We just want to finish. I'm sure some of you have seen this before, you know, Taylor Molly, but I think this is a message that people can't hear enough. You know, this is a difficult place to live in this kind of a practice, but I think it's very important.
He says the problem with teachers is, what's a kid going to learn from someone who decided his best option in life is to become a teacher? He reminds the other dinner guests that it's true what they say about teachers, that those who can do, and those who can't teach. My tongue instead of his, and resist the urge to remind the other dinner guests that it's also true what they say about lawyers. Because we're eating, after all, and this is polite conversation. I mean, you're a teacher, Taylor. Be honest. What do you make? And I wish you hadn't done that. To be honest, because you see, I have a policy about honesty and ass-kicking, which is, if you ask for it, then I have to let you have it. Anything less than your very best. You want to know what I make? I make kids sit through 40 minutes of study hall in absolute silence. You cannot work in groups. No, you can't ask a question. Why won't I let you go to the bathroom? Because you're bored and you don't really have to go. You want to know what I make? I make parents tremble in fear when I call dinner time. This is Mr. Molly. I'm calling a bad time. I just wanted to talk to you about something that your son did today. He said, leave the kid alone. I still cry sometimes, don't you? And it was the noblest act of courage that I have ever seen. I make kids question. I make them criticize. I make them apologize and limit. I make them write, and then I make them read. I make them spell definitely beautiful, over and over again until they will never misspell either one of those words again. I make them show all their work in math and then hide it on their final drafts in English. I make them realize that if you got this, then you follow this, and if somebody tries to judge you, based on what you make, you give them this. Everybody get down on you so you know what I say is true. I make a goddamn difference. Now what about you?
Eyes every time I see him.
Me too.
And I am actually, I have the distinction of being unlucky enough, I'm speaking at a conference in Manila in the Philippines next year, and Taylor Malley is also one of the speakers up there. And I really hope I ain't up against
it. At the website for this, for all of my talks here at BLC, you can find all the resources from this talk. Slides and audio from the conversation will be posted here later. The chat that you've been having will be archived here, and you'll be able to get it. Any links that were shared or resources will be available here. Some of you were taking notes in Google Docs. If you wouldn't mind terribly publishing those Google Docs as web pages and then dropping the links into the chat, so other teachers can have access to what you thought and push back a little bit. Conversation can be had in the comments here if you wish, but the pictures that you took ended up here, and this is what you did. The pictures you were taking were sent to my Flickr account, where they were automatically tagged with the tag for this talk using another tool. I then had them suck on that tag to drop them in the slideshow. And I added music in, free music that I got from Jamendo.com, was limited. So thank you all for coming out. We really appreciate the time you devoted to spending the end of the conference with us. And have a great end of conference. You're welcome to watch the end of the slideshow. Thank you.